Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that's a song called The Early King, and it comes from an album from BBD called Safe Inside the Day. And I wanted to play that because my guest tonight has written a book called The Early King and The Kid in Yellow. And Danny Denton's going to be picking all the music tonight. Danny, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be on.
It's actually been a while, Danny, since the book came out and we first mooted the idea of you coming on. So I'm glad we finally got it together that you would come in. But you live in Cork, of course, so it's far away.
It's far away. But I'm Mystery Train is in my house at least three nights a week, I would say, because I'm cooking dinner to it. So for the last year and a half, I've been cooking the dinner to Mystery Train.
Oh, that's good. I'll keep that in mind.
Thinking, what will my selections be when I get on? And sure, when the time comes, then you're
well, that'll actually affect my selections too, thinking that somebody is cooking. I happen to play that song, The Early King, and your book is called The Early King and The Kid in Yellow. Is there any connection between the song and the book?
There is a connection. It's a kind of a strange one. So when I was kind of doing some of the reading for this book that will kind of inform it, like I was reading quite a bit of Goethe, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but he has a poem and it's called Der Erlkönig, which I think translates as the Elf King. And it's a poem about a boy on the back of his father's horse and they're riding home at night and the boy keeps saying, Der Erlkönig is chasing after us, he's going to touch me. And the father keeps looking around and he sees darkness. He's like, there's nothing there, don't worry about that. And by the time he gets home, their Erlkönig has touched the boy and the father turns around to get him off the horse and he's dead. And I remember finding that poem going, God, that is so spooky. And kind of reading around it. And then I saw, oh, this Baby D has a song based on it called The Early King. So, and I was blown away. And I got to meet Baby D. She played in the Crane Lane in Cork. I got to meet her and chatted to her. She was lovely. And I couldn't get that idea out of my head. And when I needed a villain for my book, I said it's going to be that spooky, ethereal kind of character. Yeah. And I had to then, I wrote Baby D a letter to say, do you mind, like, there was no copyright issue because it's based on a poem, but do you mind, like, do you have any problem if I go ahead with this? And she wrote me this gorgeous letter back explaining how the poem was about her father and, like, I think her... She had a brother who choked at the breakfast table on a piece of bacon at some point. It was all about that memory of kind of tragedy and thing. And I was like, oh, wow. And there were loads of things that actually chimed with the book, even though there was no real relation between the song and the book. There were loads of chimes. So it was just a really, really lovely, lovely thing. She's retired now.
Really?
She retired in December.
Didn't know that. So, Danny, we're going to talk about... Your life as a writer and your life in Passage West, really.
Yeah.
Always strikes me as a kind of a place in the far northern reaches of Canada or somewhere. But we'll come to that in a minute. Your first musical choice
My first musical choice is a Passage West song. It's going to be You Got the Love, The Source featuring Candy Staton. And essentially, I wanted to pick a song from the early days, and it was between this and Ash. Because my earliest engagement probably with music in a very real way was recording songs off Atlantic 252.
Yeah.
And you'd hear them in the disco. So there'd be a disco down in the soccer club of a Friday evening or whatever.
Now what year are we talking about now? We're
going far-ish back. So we're probably talking between 90... I was born in 1983. We're talking 95.
Sorry, you were born when?
83. 83.
Oh, man. You were born.
But I feel old now, to be honest, talking, you know, some of the younger people you meet around. But Yeah, so 90, probably you're talking 95, you go to your first school disco, you're under 12s, it's very innocent. And then by 98, you're 15, and it's not that innocent at all. But Candy Staten, Ash, Entrance, all these different things were playing. And then you try and you get on Atlantic 252 and I used to have the Ghetto Blaster in the bunk bed. I shared a room with my brother and I'd be trying to record. You'd have record and pause hit and you'd be waiting to hit on pause when the song you wanted came on. So I wanted to start with one of those songs. So if you've got Candy Staten, we'll go for
You Got the Love.
You go for that.
And that's Candy Staten there and the Now Voyager radio mix of You Got the Love, the choice tonight, the first choice of my guest tonight, Danny Denton. Now, Danny, you mentioned earlier Passage West. What sort of a place is Passage West? Because it does sound a bit like some kind of frontier in the Arctic somewhere.
It is a frontier of sorts, but it's more of a frontier maybe to nicer places like Monkstown and Crosshaven and then West Cork. I feel very happy to have grown up there, even though it's probably not the most gorgeous place or whatever. But as to Passage people, like, it's interesting that you said frontier, because Passage people, I grew up, when I was about 15, I was pulling pints in the local pub where I was quite tall. So I was first collecting glasses and then she was like, you can just pull pints, you look old enough. And I often felt like I was living in the Wild West. I felt like I was living in Deadwood, you know, or a place like that. Because people, it's kind of a strange place. I don't know what the affinity is with Westerns and country music and things like that, but Passage definitely had that vibe where there was, there was the hawk strolling around town, there was the crab, there were all these different kind of local characters, lads wearing cowboy hats, lads wearing kind of Vietnam fatigues and things.
Wow.
Have that kind of frontier aspect, but that was all kind of it was storyland to us.
The sort of place where, I'm thinking of, say, San Francisco or other places like that where maybe Dingle to an extent, where people who have been moving just kind of end up there because there's nowhere else to go. That becomes the end of the road in a sense. So San Francisco's full of people like that who have literally drifted across America and they end up in San Francisco.
Well, Passage now, actually, I should say. I haven't lived there for a long time. I've been moving around since I went to college probably, but it is unrecognizable now because it's a suburb. And this is the kind of thing you're talking about, but in a way more mundane way. Basically, Cork City, 6 miles away, they started filling in the gaps with housing estates. So now we were the first. We were the first of probably 15 or 20, and it's now a suburb. There's housing, I think, I can think of a 1 mile stretch of road that doesn't have houses along it now for all the way into the city. So, and it is loads of people who come to work in Cork. People come from different places and it's a real multicultural place now. And it's lovely, my last year playing GA with them or whatever, you're seeing all these young guys coming up completely wild surnames and stuff, which is just really, really nice. I don't know what that does for the dynamic of the town. Do all these people come in and be part of the town or do all these people use it as a station on their way into work?
Let's have your next choice, Danny.
So my next choice comes from the schoolroom second year in St. Peter's Community School. Fiona Calacon hands me a tape an album called The Bends, and I suddenly, what's this strange thing? And I became obsessed with Radiohead. Then I picked Let Down from OK Computer. I think it's the best album released in my lifetime.
That's a big statement.
Yeah, and I picked Let Down because I think.
But then
it's
you
just
were born in 1983.
It's true. Yeah, that's why I always had on in my lifetime. This is not that lot. It's not that much of a selection.
Okay, Let Down, Radiohead. And that's Radiohead. Let Down from OK Computer. The second choice from my guest tonight, the novelist Danny Denton. Danny, you mentioned surnames a moment ago. Your own surname, Denton, you know, as you know, if you wanted to impress the swanks in London with your publishing lunches, you could have called yourself Denton's
had a funny journey because, so we're blow-ins to passage, I should mention. My mother's from Waterford and my father is from Clapham Junction in London. And Denton comes from London. But when they looked into it, Denton actually comes from Monastereven or somewhere.
Really, does it?
And originally it's Norman or something. Yeah. So it actually was originally, even though I was called the English kid for ages, we moved over from England when I was 5 or 6. I was the English lad for ages, but actually it's an Irish name.
But, of course you would have had an English accent and everything at that age. You were an English kid.
I arrived with an English accent and I think I went into senior infants and within a week I had an Irish accent.
And was that acquired quickly or was it just, does that just happen?
We could have a deep philosophical conversation about
this.
Why
not? This is the place.
Because I think maybe, like I was interviewed Pat McCabe recently and talked about mimicking, like when you're writing, you start out as a mimic. Mm-hmm. And Pat McKay is obviously he's an amazing mimic, like in person he's an amazing mimic. And maybe there's something in the writing spirit is that you're good at mimicry. Like I would find myself, I spent a summer in America, the usual J1 crack, and having little American twangs to my voice very quickly. I lived in Galway for 3 years. I still have a bit of go, like I don't have a passage accent exactly. I still have kind of a bit more of a rounded toward Cork towards Galway accent. But then down in Cork in the pub with my pals, I'm like, nah, 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 you know, like, so there's something of mimicry in it. And so maybe that was the reason, or maybe it was just desperation to fit in. But within a week, I was Irish. I wasn't let forget that I came from England for quite some time.
Kind of like Derry Girls, really, isn't it?
But maybe. I haven't seen it yet. I've got to catch up on Derry Girls, actually.
You should. I've watched it twice now.
Yeah, is it that good?
It's hilarious, yeah.
Yeah, I've got to catch up. And I'm not big. We don't have a TV in our house. And we do watch shows on the laptop, but it means we're very slow. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's the 1983 thing again. This could become a theme. What did your folks do, by the way?
My mum was a dental nurse. She now trains healthcare assistants. And my dad was a social worker in Mount St. Joseph's, which is kind of a kid's home in Passage.
And when you get to the age you are now, does your connection with England, does it feature at all? Does it register even?
I have a strong connection with England now, but more so because I went back and lived there. And we'll play a couple of songs maybe later on that kind of about that connection. But when I was growing up, I was adamant that I wanted to get away from England. Like I wanted to get away from Englishness, being English. I was very anti-English all the time. I don't know if this is true, but I remember my mum saying to me once that my personality changed completely. So we grew up on a council estate in Camberwell in England, which then was like rough as anything, and now is kind of full of budding artists, which is like, you know, the way of things. But we grew up in a council estate. I've very few memories, but the memories are of concrete, mortar, brick. I think I have a memory of the hurricane in 1987 because I remember slates flying around and crashing sounds and things. But as soon as we got to Ireland and we'd been on holidays and things, so I had a notion of what I was in for. My mom said I became way more sociable, way more outgoing and stuff like that. So I think growing up as a teenager, I just wanted to get away from any notion of Englishness. I was embarrassed by my English family and stuff like that. And funnily enough, I didn't think my dad, I don't know if this is a psychological block, I never thought my dad had an English accent. It was only when I was a teenager and they were like, your dad's like got a pure Cockney accent. I was like, no, he doesn't. I thought he had an accent because he very quickly picked up Irish ways of saying things, but he still has his, and today he still has his English accent. But it's very, very strange. But yeah, the dad worked in the Mountain Passage and that was a really nice way in because we used to hang around a lot with the kids there. It was a connection. We all went to the, like, Passage is a small enough place in terms of everyone went to the same primary school and it was a small primary school and stuff like that. And Mam, yeah, she had to give up work for a while to raise. It was four of us, and none of us were easy. So, yeah. Okay. And now she, yeah, now works as a healthcare assistant. And they're both brilliant at their jobs, which is really nice.
Your next choice is Damon Albarn. But tell me a little bit about this, because people know from Blur. I'm into him at the moment because of the Good, the Bad, and the Queen.
Which is,
and you know, talking about England and Englishness and so on. He's getting into that.
Yeah, he handles it. Oh man, he handles it well. And this is part of it. So I originally said I have to get a Blur song on there because I was growing up and Blur versus Oasis Britpop was real, and it was a thing in the classroom. Who were you, Blur or Oasis? And just going into secondary school, I used to pretend I was Oasis. I did like Oasis, but I preferred Blur. I used to pretend I was Oasis to fit in with my gang. You didn't want to be seen as the Blur lad in my gang. So I had to. I was like, I'm definitely going to put a Blur on there to just to make amends. But then when I realised I had to have Damon Albarn, I had to have something off this Dr. D. So this is kind of my Blur choice, but it's Damon Albarn. This is from a Chinese opera he did in Manchester about Jonathan Dee, who was kind of... in the 1600s, he was a mathematician and alchemist. I don't think really science then was what it is now. So alchemy, astrology, the occult was all involved in his thing.
He conjured angels.
He conjured angels. Conjure angels? To discover the source of creativity. It was this beautiful Faustian kind of dream.
The reason I know this is because his co-conspirator, his buddy, was a guy called Kelly.
Ah, Thomas Kelly.
No. No, that was my father. He never did that. was it Edward Kelly?
Edward Kelly.
Was it Edward Kelly?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, he spelled his name K-E-L-L-E-Y, but he's definitely still one of us.
Yeah, and there are songs on the, it's the soundtrack to this opera, there are songs that are sung in the voice of Edward Kelly as well, I think.
I'm not sure of his name now. I'll have to check that. But anyway, Dr. D and Kelly, and they were up to all sorts. But I think they had a direct line to Elizabeth I and everything.
He was the advisor to Queen Elizabeth I. Yeah. He was the advisor to Queen Elizabeth I, and there he was trying to summon angels on her behalf to discover the source of all creativity. Mm. And Damon Albarn has a chat with Alan Moore, the great graphic novelist or however you want to term it, cartoonist, writer. And they come up with this idea that they're going to do it on a Chinese opera. I'd love to have seen it. I found out about it long after it was over. And again, actually going this, I kind of discovered this as part of my kind of Faust research for the book and things. But this song, is The Moon Exalted, is just, it's absolutely gorgeous. And the way it flows, like, you kind of, if you mention Damon Albarn to people on the street, they'll say like, oh yeah, Boys and Girls or something like that. And the range the guy has of talents, of interests, is just phenomenal.
Okay, here's The Moon Exalted, Damon Albarn. Music there from Damon Albarn's opera, Dr. D, the opera soundtrack. The choice of Danny Denton is with me in studio tonight. He's an interesting character, Albarn, isn't he? I mean, as you say, you know, when you were a Blur fan back in the day, it all seemed kind of a bit kind of, you know, lads in the park kind of stuff. But a lot more to him.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Now, when you were a young kid, much younger than you are now, do you remember the first time music kind of got a hold of you? Now, the reason I'm asking you this question is I know you're a music fanatic, and I know that for you to put together, you know, 14 or so tracks for tonight was tricky, and you started off with about 100 tracks. And
So
I know you've been paying attention to music for a long time. When you were young, as a kid, maybe, you know, 6 or 7, whatever it was, you first got a grip, got a notion about it. What was it?
The earliest thing that I remember is the Bangles' Eternal Flame being played in our house.
That's a good start.
And I was going to be one of my choices, but again, as we were saying, 100 down to 14 is difficult. So I kind of decided I'd have to try and theme it somehow. But the Bangles didn't make the cut. But that, I remember just being absolutely in love with that song, not knowing who it was, and not knowing for years who it was. Like maybe when I was a teenager, that song came randomly on the radio and said, oh, I've just remembered my childhood. So that would have been, but the. Then, like, you're in the mainstream when you're a kid, aren't you? So, like, the first tape I ever bought was New Kids on the Block. And then I was, and then it was listening to the compilations, Now 97, Now, all those kind of things. But I think where I actively became a participant is probably Atlantic 252 and trying to record songs off the radio. And then the next step from recording songs off the radio is making mixtapes. And that's my first experience probably of joy in music, is the idea of sharing it with someone else. Mm. You know what I mean? Someone you fancy early in, you know, when you're 12. You know, one of the joys of art in general is putting together things and sharing them with people, right? It's been one of the joys of editing the Sting and Fly this past while. Is
the Sting and Fly is a very well-known literary journal, which comes out, what, many times a year?
Comes out twice a year now.
And you have quite recently become the editor of...
And it's like, it was very daunting at the start, but that fundamental joy again, of it's like essentially like making a mixtape, but it's for the world. Like, I mean, you do a Mystery Train, you know, most nights of the week. You're putting together this beautiful mixtape and people can engage in it. And that is like probably one of the fundamental joys. Other than making art yourself, that's one of the fundamental joys. And I loved it. Making with my pals, I remember Niamh McNamara coming up and giving me a tape, and I had Foo Fighters on it. I'd never heard of the Foo Fighters before. Things, you know, like, it's just, it's marvellous. But then becomes very stressful when you're asked on Mystery Train and they say you've got this many songs. You're like, oh boy.
And what was the first music then that, you know, really kind of captured you? You know the way people discover, it could be Bowie, it could be Bob Dylan, whatever it is.
No, I think it's Radiohead. I think I got handed that tape by Fionn, and I remember like queuing outside... Virgin arrived late, much later. It must have been HMV or Golden Discs. I remember queuing outside Golden Discs, Merchant's Quay in Cork, waiting for this album to come out. So I think it's what would you call like a social badge as well when you're in school. So you've got your Blur versus Oasis type thing. And then when you're queuing for CDs, I think that's when I'm actively engaged. And the beauty of things then is when you got the CD, you paid like 2 weeks pocket money for it or whatever it might have been. You're going to force yourself to listen it over and over again. And one of my, if I have a bit of grief now about music, one of the things is I probably don't give things half the attention. Yeah. If something doesn't grab you in the first listen, there's just something else on Spotify, or there's something else someone's tweeted about or whatever.
But then the older you get, you see, the less opportunity you do get to lie in your bedroom listening to a record. I mean, that doesn't, you know, as you grow up, that's not really so feasible.
This, I haven't actually vocalized this yet, but have you ever experienced a nostalgia for boredom?
Yes,
I've noticed lately I get really nostalgic if I'm happen to be somewhere where I don't have headphones in and no one's talking to me, and say I just see a strip of pavement or something. I get suddenly really nostalgic for just sitting on the pavement outside the gaff, trying to figure out, what am I going to do? All my pals are having their dinner or whatever it might be. No one's around. What am I going to do?
I
miss it. You know?
Well, you need to somehow try and create that kind of space for yourself, but it's not always possible. It's rarely possible now.
Getting off spending less time on the internet for me would be a start, because I'm on it too much.
Well, ideally, I must admit, I would get off everything.
I would
withdraw from the whole shooting gallery.
Yeah.
But then the minute you do that, you realise that, sir, your life stops.
Yeah.
You don't exist anymore.
You become a ghost. Yeah. You become a social ghost. But it'd be interesting to see if it does happen. Like, you know, movements go back and forth, up and down. It'd be interesting to see if people do start just going, enough is enough.
Well, I mean, like, I use Twitter a lot because, not so much recently, but I do use it for work purposes, you know, just to let people know that your show is on and stuff like that. But I don't think Twitter is your friend.
I don't think it's... At the start, I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think it's too much. It's just too much. It's overwhelming, you know?
And do you think Twitter is having an effect, and social media in general, but I'm thinking Twitter in particular because it's the one I know best, has an effect on the creative life of a place? Because a lot of people who are creative, musicians and writers and so on, feel obliged to be on social media. Whereas, you know, you can be damn sure Seamus Heaney was never on it.
Yeah. Would Heaney have been on it if it was contemporary to it? Probably not. No. And there are people like
Kevin Barry'd been in his office writing poems.
Yeah.
And Kevin Barry's not on Twitter, you know?
But it's also, it's not, see, We're having this conversation on. I've been saying for the last couple of weeks, I think I'm going to get off. And actually saying it on the radio actually means it probably will happen, which is great. But all these things start from a good place. Like Twitter, there was a time for me in my life when Twitter was great because I was discovering all these things. So like a new Maria Somerville record comes out, a brand new person. It would have taken months for me to hear of her except Twitter. So that's a really cool thing. But when you just get overexposed and Twitter breeds massive anxiety, it becomes too much. In terms of what it does for a creative place, I can see the good in it in that everyone hears about things much quicker, right?
Yep.
So you hear about books that you wouldn't have heard about. Word of mouth is like instant and rapid. But then when you get too much of it, which I think everyone probably has now, it erodes the actual word of mouth, the lovely feeling of word of mouth where someone says, puts a book into your hand and says, have a read of this, rather than you just going, I've got 15 books that I've been recommended while I ate my cereal this morning.
About anxiety as well, I mean, and everybody presenting their best self. If you were a young musician or you were a young novelist and you look at Twitter, you would think everybody is hugely successful.
Yeah.
You know, and meanwhile, you can't finish the sentence or you're struggling with paragraph one, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm pleased to announce the publication of my next 17 novels after a 12-way auction. You know, this, you would actually think, you would think there was nothing to it.
And you spent the morning trying to finish one paragraph. Absolutely.
In the full knowledge that nobody, well, in the full expectation that nobody will ever publish it or even see it.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's got to be damaging, you know, if you start to think the other thing is normal.
I think what it does probably is it adds to the discipline. So, like, I would be very disciplined in terms of I get up in the morning and I write for X amount of hours and there's no going on Twitter.
Yeah.
There's no going on the Guardian website. There's no checking the GAA scores, any of that until the writing's done. But that's a habit, and habits are difficult at the start. So like that wasn't always that way, and it's not easy that it's that way. You could easily slip out of it because, I don't know, something you were on the radio last night, and you want to see on Twitter if people have mentioned it or if you've got a new follower or
it's not your friend.
It's not ultimately your friend. Okay. There's definite benefit in it, but it's not your friend anymore.
Your next choice is My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah.
Those guys weren't messing around on social media, that's for sure.
No, I wonder, is Kevin Shields on social media? Probably not. They're not, actually, funnily enough, I was kind of raiding my Spotify for songs and they're not on Spotify.
Right.
Which probably tells you what their stance is.
You see, Kevin Shields, again, strikes me as one of those musicians who was out of it all. Was apart from everything.
Yeah.
And they're often the ones who do the best work, aren't they? They're kind of outliers in some way.
And I've been wondering this lately about kind of subcultures, countercultures. You wonder, is there a whole world of things? Because the easy thing to say is nobody would hear about your garage band gig if you weren't on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, right? Yeah. But is there an underground or sub scene around the place where people are not on Twitter and they're putting on shows, they're putting things on? I don't know the answer to that question, but it's lovely to think that there might be a My Bloody Valentine out there making innovative work and we don't hear about them because we're all on Twitter. And that would be a great reason to get off Twitter, because you'll open your eyes to the streets again. I mean, you might see a poster somewhere that says, if you want to see a gig, come here.
That's a good thought.
Do you know, that would be lovely.
My Bloody Valentine, to hear knows when. My Bloody Valentine, to hear knows when, from Loveless, the choice of Danny Denton, who's with me in studio tonight. Danny, we'll have one more musical choice before we take a quick break. I noticed the name Jennifer Walsh down here. Now, I've come across Jennifer Walsh and her music a few times in the past. Where did you first find Jennifer Walsh? Because she's another one who, you know, you could grow up listening to pop music or trad music or country music. You never, ever in a million years come across Jennifer Walsh.
Yeah. I first came across Jennifer Walsh. Actually, it's only recently enough that I've realised who Jennifer Walsh is and that she has all this massive body of work. But a pal of mine who's a music journalist in London said, if you're interested in, and we were talking about avant-garde, subculture kind of stuff. So if you're interested in the avant-garde, he said, go on this website, askjock.org. AISTEACH.org. And I was like, oh, what's this? And it's like a compendium of all this avant-garde Irish music. And there are all these strange stories about Dadaists, satanic rituals and kind of soundtracks to satanic rituals that people were making. I was like, my God, this is a whole section of Ireland I never would have thought existed. I thought that all that kind of subculture stuff happened in Liverpool and Manhattan and wherever else, Brooklyn and all these places. And then you click on the disclaimer for the website and you find out that it's all fiction. It's all made up. But the music is actually, you can listen to the music. It's real music. But all the stories are fictional. All the artists are fictional. And it's the brainchild of Jennifer Walsh. So I said, okay, this is really cool. I'm initially upset because I'm like, oh, I've just had five amazing artists who record, you know, the sounds of themselves shaving over kung fu things, samples. And then you realize, yeah, oh, it's all one person. But then, of course, you get to discover the person behind it. And she's making this incredible work of kind of disruption and dissonance, and so, and I'm only now understanding how much there is, which is great. Because
and do you respond to artists like that? Because you know you're a novelist and you're under, you know, a certain amount of pressure if you choose to accept it to produce work that people will buy. You know that will sell, that will work in a marketplace. You could do the equivalent using words, but I mean nobody's ever going to see it. Because no one will publish it. So what do you, yeah. You know, we get an artist like Jennifer Walsh who does her own thing. And she's highly, highly regarded in the circles in which she is known.
Mm.
But and, she's never, ever going to be number one on the charts.
No, no. And I wonder, you wonder would people choose to be like, my deal, I think when you have a book come out, you really want it to do well. And you really want everyone to be talking about it. And you really want it to sell well. And you might want to do that because maybe you want to be famous. You want everyone to know you. Or you might want to do it because you want to earn enough money to do another book.
To do another
or
one.
To buy a house or yeah. whatever.
As opposed to a swimming pool and a helicopter.
Or a swimming pool and a helicopter, yeah. You know, if you're doing that well, right? If you're Max Porter, maybe. But like, so I think that you can get easily confused or you can want both. And I've realized in the publication of one book, I want enough money to do the next thing. I have no interest anymore. I did want to be well known. I did want to be well reviewed and I did want to be, everyone wants to be liked, of course. But now I realize I want to go down the Jennifer Walsh, because you need to decide, if you're lucky enough to have one book published, if you're going to have a second book published, you need to decide who are you? Are you the guy who only writes dystopian fiction? Are you the guy who writes thrillers? Are you the guy who writes comedies? Or are you the weirdo and you never know what they're going to write next? Or are you the person who is experimental, that kind of a tag like that? So I think like you do have to make a choice, and the riskier choice is to do your own thing. And I think it strikes me that Jennifer Walsh does her own thing, but it also strikes me she clearly can make a living out of it and she's doing well. So that's like probably the perfect thing. That's the perfect solution, that you're so good at doing your own thing that people listen anyway. And there are people like, it's amazing work, you know what I mean? If you can sit down, and it's probably not going to be on 2FM like anytime soon, as you say. She's not going to win
either.
She's not going to win probably a Grammy for it or anything like that, but it's phenomenal, weird, interesting and true art, you know what I mean? So,
and what are we playing here in Manhattan?
I think we're playing Manhattan. Yeah, it was kind of hard to choose because a lot of the pieces are long. They usually have very interesting investigations using samples of interviews or voices. Manhattan, I think, kind of encapsulates her style the best.
Okay. Music there from Jennifer Walsh, Manhattan. The choice of Danny Denton is with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of Danny's choices. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone to pick the music. And tonight it's the novelist Danny Denton who's picking all the tunes. Danny, when did the writing start for you, do you think?
The writing started probably, I think everyone writes at a very young age. So like writing stories about magic rings in the garden and leprechauns and things early on. And then...
Now, how early was that?
Primary school. I remember, I have specific memories of writing Roald Dahl kind of rip-off poems in the back of my hardcover notebook. In fourth class, probably. And there were kind of songs about evil dentists and crocodiles and things like that.
If I was your agent, I'd try and get those published.
They're probably a bit too Roald Dahl now.
Evil dentists and crocodiles.
Yeah, universal themes. Wow. Universal themes of literature, obviously. And then teenage years, I kind of was mad into writing things, but at teenage years, I didn't show a bit of interest in it. I was too busy playing ga, trying to impress girls and, you know, trying to be cool music-wise and things like that. And then I think when I was 17, 18, I started again. I almost had that thing, and I was talking about this at an event recently, and I bet you had it too at school as a writer. You were hoping your essay might get, you'd write an essay for class and you're hoping that the teacher might say, read it out because it was good. And that was like the first time I probably felt like really, really cool and valid, like I'd done something cool, and the teacher said, we're going to ask Danny to read his short story because his homework was so good or whatever.
Oh, that's the last thing I'd have wanted, because you'd have been torn limb from limb by your comments.
Well, yeah, there was that too, but there was
Who do you
a
think you are writing? Writing, are you?
Maybe a secret pride, but then I took a year out. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I did my leaving cert. So I took a year off and I went off to China. I got like a 1 week TEFL course and I went off to China as an 18-year-old.
As you do.
And taught English for a year. And it was there that I started to write.
Was that kind of a sudden, it just sort of happened or what? Had you planned on China?
What? No, I had planned on Japan. I'm obsessed with Japan. But Japanese
geography wasn't great, yeah.
Are far more mature in their hiring policies. You need to do like have a degree and a TEFL course. I did a 1 week TEFL course on the North Mall in Cork City as an 18-year-old. I turned up for 1 week, passed the test, and went and got a job in the middle of China, in the middle of nowhere in China, in this like I'm actually a massive teaching university, like a Marriott in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
And it was there. I said I would keep a journal. And I started reading a lot because no one spoke. There were 7 foreign teachers in this university and they were the only like native English speakers or whatever. So I was reading an awful lot. And then I said, oh yeah, I kind of rediscovered that thing that I was probably doing when I was reading the twits and then trying to write a poem afterwards. I was like, I was reading, say, for example, Hemingway, and then my journal would take on this Hemingway-esque tone, even though I was like sitting on my own drinking green tea rather than like, you know, drinking, you know, brandy in the Ritz or whatever. But I started seriously, and then by the time I was halfway through that year, I knew I was going to go back to UCC. I wanted to do English and philosophy, and I was going to take a stab at trying to become a writer. There was no creative writing BA at that time or anything like that. And then I did an MA in writing in Galway, and then Bob's your uncle, I'm writing every day since then.
There's two things I want to ask you about that. You mentioned boredom earlier, and you had a nostalgia for boredom. Mm. Were you bored in China?
I don't know if I was bored. I probably spent a lot of time on my own, but I was doing something that was very difficult to me, which was I was teaching for the first time. And so I spent a lot of time planning stuff, a lot of time reading, a lot of time, towards the end actually, a lot of time missing home. I probably don't admit that enough, but I missed home an awful lot towards the end.
And you were in the middle. I mean, I was in Beijing once, which was sort of blow your mind in lots of ways, but you were in the middle of nowhere,
weren't
you?
In the middle of nowhere. I was probably 2 hours. Not quite. I was in a place called Huanggang, which was 2 hours from Wuhan, which is like the Athlone of China. So like I was essentially in Kinnegad or something, you know what I mean? And it took 2.5 hours to get, say, to the nearest city. So the nearest McDonald's was 2.5 hours away. Yeah,
so there's no forbidden city or fancy food
What I would say is, and going back to that boredom question, I didn't get bored either because I had this beautiful timetable where I taught Monday afternoon till Thursday afternoon, which meant Thursday afternoon after class I got on a train and I went travelling, like, and I earned decent. I wasn't rich over it, but I earned enough to travel.
She had a whole weekend,
Thursday,
long weekend,
every
weekend
I was gone, and I come back, make sure I just come back, because they're brilliant with sleeper trains over there. So I'd come back Monday morning, having been in Beijing, having been in Shanghai, Chengdu, all these wonderful, weird and wonderful places. So I did do a lot of travelling, and again, loads of reading, loads of sitting on trains.
So, and the other thing is this, you mentioned, you know, MAs and writing and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Would you put a lot of stock in that, becoming a writer via learning how to be one, if you know what I mean?
I wouldn't.
Yeah.
It was brilliant for me. What it's like is like cutting a massive corner, like 5 years of learning hard lessons. You learn them in 1 year. And the best thing about it is it's a year to be a full-time writer. So I spent a year where you have classes, but like you might have 10 hours a week of classes. And I was working part-time because I paid for it myself. So I was trying to pay off. I got a loan or whatever, I was trying to pay it off. So I was working. But every morning you get, like, and that's where my routine started. I still have the routine to today. Like, you know, get up at 7:30 or 6:30, whatever is required based on your work timetable, and you write for a few hours and then you head off and you do your day, and you might come back and edit in the evening or whatever. But that started then, and I had a year to be more or less a full-time writer, which was brilliant. And you're surrounded by like-minded individuals, which is also brilliant, because you think you're well-read because you've read two Hemingway books, an F. Scott Fitzgerald book, and The Bell Jar, right? Mm. And then someone rocks up and goes, but have you not heard of like Burroughs and all these lads, like, or have you not heard of the Russians? And all of a sudden it's this amazing, going back to that thing of sharing art, this amazing swap shop of ideas. And you kind of, like, one of my best friends till today would have been given us our next selection, would have given me that and said, wait till you hear this, now you're going to love this. And having that kind of environment, plus writing full time, plus having a teacher. I had Mike McCormack teaching me fiction. I had Mikey O'Gorman and Mary O'Malley teaching me poetry, which I was terrible at. But that's really, really valuable. But that's not to say that if you didn't do a master's, you couldn't write. Like, it's just, I think you probably learn the lessons a bit quicker. And
yeah, but still, to get the benefit of the experience of someone like Mike McCormack, both as you know, in the writing itself and the writer's life.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's good to know all that.
Absolutely.
You know?
And we had speakers come to us every week. Like, there's a speaker series there. So, like, Dermot Healy sat in front of me for 40 minutes when I was 22, listening to his favourite words.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what a gift.
Brilliant.
You know?
Your next choice is Lamb Chop.
Yeah. And that, like I said, it's an album that was given to me by Kieran Dowd. Not maybe first few weeks of college, have a listen to this, man, you'll like this one, and off you go. Like, it's just amazing.
In the hour of the girl, you can make this danger witness.
Lamb Chop is a woman, the choice of Danny Denton, who's with me in studio tonight. Danny, when you started reading for the first time, outside of school, for instance, what were you drawn to?
When I was very young, it was the stock stuff, Roald Dahl, the Hardy Boys, all those kind of things. And then, and comics, loads of Beanos and Dandies. And then coming out of secondary school, it was people like Stephen King. I was obsessed with Stephen King for a long time. Not the horror so much as he has a big fantasy series called The Dark Tower. That was a big one for me. And then if I decide I want to try and write things, I should read more things. And I start reading Hemingway, and I start reading F. Scott Fitzgerald. I didn't read that much Irish stuff early on, bar maybe The Butcher Boy was massive because, you know, like, everyone loves The Butcher Boy, and rightly so. And I wasn't reading so much other Irish stuff. I was terrified of Joyce or anything like that. But then once you read a couple of really great books, say, for example, Tender is the Night or The Bell Jar, or something, for example, Margaret Atwood, all of a sudden then whole new worlds are reading open up, and I feel like I've been in a game of chase ever since then, trying to get the next thing read. There's something I haven't read, there's a blind spot, and I've been doing, like, I feel like I've been doing that ever since. The things that have really stuck with me probably are more modernist-y things, like T.S. Eliot is a massive one for me, a massive one for my book. And
when did you start to think, I would like to attempt this activity myself?
Probably around then, and it's weird, I still have my initial attempts at, I had an idea for a novel, and it was going to be set it was going to be said that this flood was threatening, kind of like that Game of Thrones line, winter is coming, like the flood is coming, the flood is coming. It'd be about these two brothers, and it was pure Stephen King, The Stand style thing. So even while I was doing my essays on T.S. Eliot and Nietzsche and things like that, I was still trying to kind of write Stephen King stuff. And then that modernist stuff started to leak into the Stephen King stuff. And then I discovered Dermot Healy, and I wanted to be Dermot Healy for 2 or 3 years. So I was trying to write in a kind of more... So it's not fair to say Dermot Healy is social realist. He's an utter modernist, actually, but in a way that we can probably recognise a lot easier than reading The Wasteland or something like that. And Dermot Healy was the person we talked... You mentioned earlier about mimicking different people and stuff. Dermot Healy was the writer I think I wanted to be. And then I managed to kind of shake off that influence enough to be myself eventually. And that's kind of where this book, The Early King, came from. But I think it's probably, those kind of amalgams and mishmashes of things, layerings of influence that kind of some things wash off, you know, like stains or something. Some things wash out and they don't come back. And then some things stay. Like, I'm sure I have a love of storytelling and narrative. And that is Stephen King. And that is probably just being told stories by my granddad and things as well. But like, Stephen King's not gone, and I don't, you know, I'm not now a snob because I like the modernists. I don't like Stephen King anymore.
If you can combine Stephen King and T.S. Eliot, then you've got a formula. A magic formula, perhaps. Your next musical choice is?
Speaking of mishmashes, it's Burial. Burial is from South London, was anonymous for a long time. I don't think he is anymore. And when I moved to London, later as an adult, around 2010. And this is where I felt a connection and listened to this kind of music, because I don't know what it stirred in me, but these kind of little two-step jungle garage kind of little influences and the sampling, it was kind of like, oh, this is the kind of book I like in sound.
Stormzy, the choice of Danny Denton, who's with me in studio tonight. Shut Up, and prior to that, Burial. So you were saying that kind of music sort of reignited several interests.
It reignited, when I moved back to London, I was at a bit of a crossroads. I'd been doing a load of kind of short-term admin jobs, temping jobs, trying to be a writer, and I kind of said I need to get a vocation. Because I know that I'll never make money from writing. I kind of given up on getting published, even though I was still writing, I'd given up on publishing deals and that kind of thing. So I trained as a teacher in London, and I started teaching in Lewisham, southeast London, which is, you know, a stone's throw from Camberwell, really, two buses, maybe 20 minutes. And I was just, it was gas, because I was saying to my, I had a mentor and stuff, and he was, I was saying, when I was growing up, like, I went to a school exactly like this. I think my first year of school was in a school exactly like this. And he was like, oh, back in 1985 or whatever, 1989, this was all Irish. And at this point, in 2011, 98% African, Caribbean immigrants and things, or immigrant families. And he was like, oh, these were all Irish. And now this was the music of the playground, the yard. This was the language the kids spoke. And I felt very close to them then. I had an awful hard time with them. Like, it was a tough job teaching in Southeast London. That kind of gave me grime I couldn't relate to before, those kind of things when I was in Ireland, probably. And then when you actually, because I don't know if you ever find this, but music kind of has a place. It's not tied to a place, but when you're in the place, hearing the music of the place.
Like, and it applies to everything, even music like Steve Reich and something like that. That's New York music. Absolutely, New York music. And it, you know, so it's true. You know, you go to the place, and it does.
And it was, and you hear, so like Stormzy's a lovely story and an important story in terms of, he's a role model. He was a kid, had trouble at school, apparently a gifted student, but had loads of trouble in a school in Southeast London. And now he is opening a publishing company for these voices, like disenfranchised voices, subcultures. And it's just brilliant. And it's really cool to hear, because he has spoken about kids rapping in the yard at school, having rap-offs with different people and things. And of course, I was seeing this every day when I was on yard duty and thinking, like, ah, what are these kids at? Like, you know, they should be playing football, they should be getting exercise. But actually, then you see it's a completely valid, wonderful, vibrant thing. So that's my London connection artist now, I think, is Stormzy and Skepta and people like that.
Do you like teaching?
I do enjoy it, actually. I've been doing a good bit of it the last year in terms of creative writing. I did a spell in NUI Galway, and I've really enjoyed
it. Apart from the creative writing stuff, you know, working with kids, and as you say, you had a tough time.
I really enjoyed working with kids, except the behaviour management side of things I found really difficult. And it's because probably in England especially, and apparently it's gone this way too in Ireland, teachers are more or less social workers in terms of they're just basically, everything is Excel spreadsheets, everything is about progress, nothing is about actually teaching kids to be better at English, nothing is about teaching kids to be better people or anything like that.
Man. So, break your
heart. It's a really, really grim environment to work in. But the teenagers, I think, are just so cool. Like, they're so full of life. They're so full of beans. They're so dramatic. And it, being part of that was lovely. And when you kind of finally win their respect, like, you come back after Christmas and they're like, oh, you haven't quit. You're still here. Okay, we like you now. You know, like, it's been marvelous. And the kids, since I've come back, the kids I had the toughest time managing behaviour with, like, in terms of they were getting detentions all the time, cursing in class, starting fights, all sorts of stuff. They're the kids I actually miss the most. You know what I mean? It's very strange. I don't know why. I can't explain that. So I do miss it, but it's like really tough. And I have the hugest respect for teachers. And I don't know if I miss that kind of get everyone to, you know, line up in a straight line. Everyone has to wear their tie. And I don't know if I miss any of that, but I do miss teaching. One of my happiest things was teaching kids William Blake. And then you get to kind of say, like, oh, this guy used to see like angels at the end of his garden. Like, this guy took drugs, right? And the kids are all like, oh, I want to read this poem now, you know? Like that, like teaching kids that kind of stuff is an absolute joy.
Your next choice. We're not going to play all of this because it's 22 minutes long, much as I'd love to. Godspeed You, Black Emperor.
Yeah, this is kind of going back to a couple of things. NUI Galway, I first heard Godspeed You, Black Emperor, and it blew my mind. And again, trying to think, kind of thinking of, I want to write something that matches this. And this is actually, I used to have a playlist right in the book, and this would have been one of the albums on the playlist, Lift Your Skinny Fist Like Antennas to Heaven. I'm not sure who recommended it to me first, but it has that kind of a darkness to it. It has a movement to it. It's kind of, or I think they call it post rock. It's kind of orchestral, but it's rocky, and it uses samples from different weird things. And it has, I think, the rhythm of a train. So I was always going to pick this one, because it kind of feels like a train setting off these first few minutes of this album.
Godspeed You, Black Emperor. And that's Godspeed You, Black Emperor, from the album Lift Your Skinny Fist Like Antennas to Heaven, track called Storm, the choice of Danny Denton, who's with me in studio tonight. That's quite something, Danny, isn't it?
Mm.
So you mentioned you had a playlist when you're writing the book. Is that helpful? I know a lot of writers do that, although some of them I kind of think it's just another angle, because then they release the CD, you know, along with the album.
Is it helpful? It was helpful for me to set a mood for myself, and I think you're always maybe looking, when you're writing, you're always maybe looking for permission in different ways. And maybe some people don't need permission. And actually the book I'm writing now, I'm not listening to really anything. I've no playlist for it or anything like that. But that one, I just felt I wanted to capture these moods. Like I was thinking of movies like Blade Runner, movies like In the Mood for Love. And I was thinking of artists like Arvo Pärt. I was thinking of Godspeed You Black Emperor and different and Burial and things like that. And you're kind of trying to match the mood. I was trying to, the world of my book wanted to match the mood of those pieces of music. So it was very useful for me in that. I didn't really, I sometimes, but not, probably I would say rarely listen to music while I was actually writing. But it might be like I was cleaning the room. I'd always have to clean the room before I sit down to write. You know, there can't be any like reasons not to write. So I would have it on then, and then I'd be like, right, it's like a warm up or something, you know, like a, like in a GAA match, like I'm warmed up now, I'm ready to go. Like I've got this, I've got Tom Waits in my head now. Here we go. Like, so it was helpful, but maybe not vital.
Tom Waits is on your list. Will you play him now?
Yeah, why not? Why not? Yeah, yeah.
Which Tom Waits do you prefer? Do you like all of them?
I love them all. Absolutely love them all. He speaks to every part of the psyche, the spirit, the heart. I have chosen Singapore, which is on Rain Dogs, because that was a really important album for me. Again, I wanted my world to be the world of Rain Dogs. And there's actually a cheeky little reference to it. There's a point in the book where this guy is surrounded by a drinker is surrounded by sailors who are shipping out for Singapore, and they're kind of heaving away and things like that. So yeah, a bit of Tom Waits would be lovely. We sailed tonight for Singapore, where all is mad as hammers here. I've fallen for a tawny moor, took off to the land of Nod, drank with all the Chinamen, walked the shores of Paris.
Tom Waits, Singapore. Danny Denton with me in studio tonight. He's picking all the music, that track from Rain Dogs. We have time for just a couple more, Danny. What about Troublesome Book 2? How's that going?
Going back to that thing.
Now, you don't have to talk about it if you don't want it.
Yeah, I can. I've figured out a way to talk about it without ruining it for myself.
Yeah.
It's going okay. I thought I had it done. So it's like I've been writing it for a year and a half now, and I finished a draft of it, and then I finished another draft of it, and then I finished another draft of it. And I said, yeah, this is it. And I shared it with someone, and they spotted the hole in it. That, you know, you're always trying to, when you're writing, you're always kind of, you see something and you go, oh, will I get away with that? Will I get away with that? And of course they came back and said, I wasn't sure about this. And I said, yeah, you're dead right. I'd been thinking that myself. And of course then, it was like Father Ted tapping the car with the hammer. I said, one little tap, but I realised I've taken the whole thing apart and put it back together again to be the thing I really wanted to be, and it should have been all along. And then that's taken a long time as well. So I'm in the middle of all that now, kind of, I'm tapping away, I'm moving parts around. And I think it's getting better, but it's also getting very weird.
Do you know when you're talking about moving parts around, a big operation, right? Big job, job to do. But you've got a thing called a laptop, probably, or a computer of some sort.
I write longhand, John.
Do you?
Yeah. I write longhand. I do type things up periodically. So like every 50 pages, I'll go back and type up what I've written, and it kind of gives me a chance to be a little bit of an editor. But I do write longhand.
But when you're doing the moving around part, are you doing that on a laptop?
I'm doing that on a laptop, and I spent 50 quid on this program called Scrivener, which is, it's essentially a Microsoft Word, but it's a novelist's dream of a Microsoft Word, because you can kind of see, it's like having everything laid out on front, you know, on the floor, and you can just physically move it. You can just drag a piece here to there, and you can see what the order of the pieces looks like. So I use that. It's very useful, especially for the amount that I'm doing. Because it's like, I don't know, I'm really bad at ironing. But you know when you iron a shirt and it's like, you think you've got it done, you're like, oh, there's that massive crease there, I need to fix that. So it's very like a long form version of that, actually.
Next choice is Katie Kim.
Next choice is me cousin, Katie Kim,
I didn't know she was your cousin. She was on here not so long ago.
Yeah, and she picked half the songs I would have picked, actually. I couldn't pick Nick Cave because of her, not Nick Cave, Johnny Greenwood. I had Johnny Greenwood down. But anyways, yeah, Katie is my cousin from Waterford, my Waterford cousin. And it's just, I picked it because I love it, actually. This song, Your Mountains, it's really nice because, you know, you have family, right? And everyone loves their family more or less. And you always want your family to do well, and you always cheer them on, even if you think what they do is rubbish. So like my dad's been cheering me on as a GA player for years and years and years, and he couldn't tell one end of a GA field from another. Like, you
what
know?
Position did you play, by the way?
I was an average midfielder and then a half decent halfback.
Yeah, you must have known what you were doing.
But I wasn't the worst.
Otherwise, they'd have put you out.
I got picked.
Otherwise, you'd have been a full forward.
Yeah, true. Yeah, lump him up. When Katie's starting out, and she started out real early, like I remember her playing cover versions when we were kids, like 12, 13 or whatever. And you just go like, oh yeah, you're great. And then I remember her first album came out. I was like, oh my God, that's actually amazing. Like, that's exactly the kind of thing I want to listen to. And it's been that way ever since. This song in particular, Your Mountains, she played it at our grandfather's funeral. It's an absolutely beautiful song. I don't know. I used to say, I don't know if anyone has a better voice in Ireland. And then Ray D. Pete came along and I thought, God, they're on a par. And then they started working together. It was just like, yeah. Oh my God, how gifted are we? And how gifted am I to be your cousin? Katie Kim.
Your Mountains. Katie Kim there, and a song called Your Mountains, the choice of Danny Denton. Danny, just before you go, you've touched on this already, and I'm sure there's people out there tonight listening who are writing, would like to write, and so on. And you did touch on this already, but what is your working life like? You've learned to be disciplined about this, haven't you?
Yeah, I've learned to be disciplined about it. It's like having three part-time jobs, really. The last couple of years, anyway, for me, have been since I gave up full-time work. You're a writer, and I write in the mornings, nearly always. I work Monday to Friday.
Starting what time?
At the moment, I start at 7:30 and I go till about 11-ish.
Well, you sit down at 7:30.
Yeah.
So you get up at what time?
I get up at 7:00.
So you sit down, you have breakfast.
Get up at 7:00, have a bowl of cereal, pet the cats for a minute, off to work I go. And then what happens is we live in a tiny one-bed place. I go downstairs, I work at the kitchen table. When Rachel gets up and she's shipping out to work, we'll swap places. I'll go up and I'll sit at the desk because we have one room upstairs. The desk is right at the end of it. So I'll go and work at the desk then. And then emails and submissions and all that kind of stuff come after that.
And this is your work to do with Sting and Fly and all the rest of it?
Or? Well, yeah, but my own, like I might have work on submissions somewhere, be sending out short stories and things like that things like that. And then in terms of the part-time jobs, I was doing quite a bit of teaching last year and teaching at the start of this year in NUIG. And then I took over as a guest editor of the Sting and Fly at the start of this year. And then that becomes another kind of part-time job. And then for that, I was reading in the afternoons. Like I read a lot for that. Got a lot of submissions, really, really, really joyful period, actually, just to read loads and loads and loads of unpublished work, which is brilliant.
Is it really when you want to do your own work? Do you know what I mean? You have to set your own work to one side to do this, you know?
Yeah, but you know, the truth of the matter is, I wonder, could I, if I was on a salary of, you know, £500,000 a year, and I didn't have to do anything else, would I write from 7:30 in the morning till 5:00 in the evening with an hour for lunch? I probably wouldn't. I don't think I think it takes too, writing is a pretty psychologically or psychically demanding thing to do. So I don't think I could do it for probably more than 4 hours a day. Now, it would be nice, obviously, you can go for a run, you can do other things, but I do like having, I am enjoying having other things, so making art is what I think I do in the mornings, and then putting art together and sharing art and helping other people make art is what I currently do for the Sting and Fly in the afternoons. And that's actually a joy of its own. Yeah. And it's a different type of pressure, and it's a different type of thing, like reading work and saying, I think you could improve this here and there. And then putting it all together and saying, this is again, going back to that mixtape feeling, here's a document we made for the world.
Now, you mentioned your partner, Rachel, going to work, right? Mm. Now, Richard Ford always says when he's asked, you know, how to be a writer, he says, you need to marry my wife, but you're going to have to go through me to get to it. He always says that because throughout his writing career, she has worked.
Yeah.
She has worked and enabled him to sit at home for a long time trying to become the Richard Ford that he is now.
Yeah, you know?
So I'd say it's important that your partner has a job.
Rachel is the breadwinner. Yeah, yeah. When we first met, Rachel was a student. So I used to kind of pay over halfway when we were living together. I pay a little bit more of the rent than she did. Full in the knowledge that when I went full time writing, eventually I'd be asking for it back. So that Rachel is the breadwinner in our house, and I'm very grateful to her for millions and millions of things. But that's just one of them.
Sounds okay, though. It sounds about right.
It works well. Yeah.
So Danny, listen, thanks a million for coming in. It was a real pleasure to talk to you and to hear your choices. And if we could, we'd do it again tomorrow night, because I know you've got lists.
With a whole different set.
List of music. So your last choice is Richard Dawson. Is he the kind of slightly wonky, folky musician?
Yes.
Everything's slightly, and dare I say it, slightly out of tune?
Yes.
I like that too.
I absolutely love it, yeah. And a master of voice. What a voice he has.
It was Eliza Carthy on this show who played Richard Dawson. She introduced
Did
me
she?
To him. Yeah, she was in your seat.
Fantastic. Yeah. I'm not alone then. Yeah, no. Newcastle troubadour, but with a dissonant, weird difference.
And what are we going to hear?
We're going to hear The Magic Bridge, which I think this was either his second or his third album. And this song is so, it's like a lullaby sung by, I don't know what it's actually about, but it's like a lullaby sung by a parent who kind of, the dream of the lullaby suddenly twists into the parent's grief or something. And the way his voice changed it is so beautiful.
Danny Denton, thanks a million.
Thank you.
There in sleep lies a magical bridge. Hidden in a grove of blossoming mist.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.